Hi, this is Neil MacDonald from Somerset in the UK, Orchard Park Farms, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 19. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. This is a weekly podcast where we speak to cider makers, people in the cider trade, and enthusiasts from around the globe. My name is Rhea Windcaller, and I am your Cider MC. And this week, we have a fantastic chat with Neil MacDonald, all the way from Somerset, England. And he'll be speaking about orchard production, like high-volume orchard production, and some of the things that he sees in the U.S. I found it very informative. Meanwhile, I can barely contain myself. I'm sitting here in Ciderville Central, and sure, I'm looking out upon the orchard. The old baldwin tree is lightly swaying ever so slightly in the soft wind coming in from the east, and I feel like I could get up and do a happy dance at any moment, because I am so absolutely pleased to announce that we have a new founding sponsor for Cider Chat. Drum roll, please. I know what you're thinking. Who dat, Rhea? As you might imagine, they have cider on their mind, and it comes from the magical land of bittersweet and bittersharp apples. Want to guess? Well, if you're thinking UK cider, you are so very right. There'll be links to these Ciderville do-gooders who go by the name Cider Sellers. You can find them at cidersellers.com. Now, make sure to get that right, because we really want to support them, Ciderville. Think cellars as in the magical place where barrels and bottles are stored for conditioning to perfection. Cider Cellars is U.S.-based and is importing cider from the U.K. I mean, crimey, pinch me already. The timing is perfect, both for this chat with Neil MacDonald and all of us hankering to get our palates primed with cider balanced with tannins and acids. From the land of cider makers who've been doing this for a very, very long time. I am just so thrilled, and this is certainly helping get the journey rolling. So do expect to be hearing from Linda at Cider Cellars during this very chat and in subsequent chats. And if you're looking to get the word out about your cider and related cider topics, please know that Cider Chat does have a media kit for interested sponsors, because this is one stepping stone of many to get us out into Ciderville and continue bringing chats back for all of us to peruse through and have as essentially an encyclopedia right from the orchard. Now, let's get on with this chat with Neil MacDonald of Orchard Park Farm. You might notice a similarity in that name with the famed Orchard Pig cider. Yep, it's all connected. I had the privilege of chatting with him at CiderCon in Portland, Oregon earlier this very month. And not only will he chat about what he sees as a viable option for cider makers here in the U.S. looking to get their own orchards rolling in productivity, but he also has a paid intern position at Orchard Park Farm that he'll be sharing with all of us. So let's grab a glass and join this chat.
You're over in the States quite a bit, but you have this kind of multi, what would we say, a sustainable farm in a way, because it's not just a cider, but cheese.
Yeah.
And it's called
Orchard Park Farm. So, yes, so why am I here? Very good question. I've been a grower of cider apples for some time, and I started a little cider business of my own back in 2004 called the Orchard Pig. But my element of that business, I had a business partner, my element of that business was always the apple growing and the primary process of the cider making, far more than the branding and selling side of the business. So I've always been a man of the soil and, you know, a farmer by heart. And
is that rooted from your family?
Yeah, so I've got a family farm, indeed, yeah. Mm. And we've always grown a small acreage, very traditionally grown a small acreage of cider apples on the farm, as it's very common across a lot of farms in Somerset. Mm. And there's a traditional orchard, so there would be for sheep grazing underneath, and apple mm-hmm. production of a standard tree, sort of 60 trees to the acre.
60 trees to the acre.
So, 60, okay. And they were always put in as a dual purpose. You'd always find a minimum of 10 different apple varieties, cider apple varieties in any one orchard, because those are the different varieties that would give the blend. They'd be quite localized, some of those varieties as well. We've got something like 2,500 different cider varieties in the UK. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you lived around the area of Yarlington, for instance, you'd have Yarlington Mill and mm-hmm. Coates Jersey and mm-hmm. other bits and pieces. If you lived around the area of Martock or Stembridge, you'd have Stembridge clusters. And so there were quite localised little varieties. Mm-hmm. Some of them have really come back and become very popular. Mm-hmm. Many of them have fallen beside the wayside for good reason, that they were no good in the first place. So it was important to have a good blend of apples to make a good cidery. And in the UK, or certainly in Somerset, you were often never more than 3 miles from a cider house. You've got to remember there's an enormous amount of tradition there. Mm. And the cider house was there because as you walked to work in the morning, you'd have called in the cider house and filled up your flagon and had a drink, and that would have been what you had drunk through the day. And then on your way home, you'd have called in the cider house, filled up enough for yourself and indeed for the family, because that's what the most of the family would have been drinking as well. It's the only thing that was safe to drink. And it is reputed that Somerset was the last county to get tap water because we really didn't want it. But in truth, there was a great tradition going on there. And many people were paid in cider until the Truck Act came in.
Yeah.
And anything up to 2 gallons, so that's in our money, wow, that was sort of 14 imperial pints per day, was a payment, as was cheese. So, and anything up to 50% of salary would be paid in cider and cheese.
Interesting.
And the better quality worker you were, the better quality cider you got, and the more you got of it. So, so the early ferment stuff that was made from some of those early varieties, which is pretty dangerous stuff because it was very live, it was still yeasty, still happening,
yeah.
And you've got to remember, it's not that long ago that we started to make really good fine filtered ciders, even in the UK. So this is the sort of stuff that you could fall foul of. You have a glass of it, tasted like apple juice,
mm-hmm.
It hit your stomach, the mm-hmm. perfect fermentation vessel, mm-hmm. The next morning you were feeling a lot less well than you were the night before, because actually the sugars in that juice were actually using your stomach as the fermentation vessel and so on.
Wow.
So we've really cleaned up our act of making cider in the UK, and that's what's made it popular more than anything else.
I see.
That it's become a popular drink.
Right.
Have I answered your question?
Wow.
Probably not at all. I've just rabbited.
I love it. I mean, it just gives me this imagery of the countryside, and I love that idea of walking, you know, to work and filling up the flagon. And what size container is that?
Well, a flagon, as we call it. And you used the word growlers over here, I think.
Yes, people have growlers.
Yeah, growlers,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it typically would be anything up to a 2 gallon. Container, so it's a fair old size, and depending on what you were paid or how important you were as to how big that vessel would be, but certainly a gallon or more, and that's a UK gallon, not a US gallon, which is slightly different.
Right, a little larger.
Yeah.
Did people trade with that, or was that, you know, just
trade?
Because they didn't have water, that was kind of the commodity.
It was. If you wanted to employ people, you needed to have good quality cider.
Mm-hmm.
The better quality your cider, the better quality your employees, mm-hmm. because you're an attractive place to work.
Right.
There is a company that you may well have heard of in the UK called Thatchers.
Mm-hmm.
Thatchers by name were Thatchers. In other words, straw was often used for the medium for making
mm-hmm.
things. There's a lovely advert they've just brought out quite recently, very, very right, and that is people came across the Thatchers farm, and when they came across the Thatchers farm, they stayed because the cider was good. In other words, the story goes, that's how they built up, and that's how they built a greater number of employees. It's a lovely traditional thing.
Yeah, it is. Wow, fascinating. And I think, you know, people listening out there in Ciderville just love this kind of lore.
Yes.
Just, you know.
Well, we've just, both of us, been sitting through a mm-hmm. piece of CiderCon mm-hmm. 2016 here in Portland,
mm-hmm.
and we've just heard three of the great cider makers of the UK. That's Tom Oliver, Neil Worley, and Barney Butterfield, all from Hereford, Somerset, and Devon, talk about the mystique of cider making in the UK and all those lovely traditions. And they put across a wonderful, warm, slightly casual and forgetful type of industry, of which, you know, part of it is, and our tradition is that. It's become much more than that, and it's become a little bit more clean cut. It hasn't become nearly as funky and as outspoken as it has here in the US, and that's really exciting.
They were pretty outspoken, though. I thought they were amazing on how they were chatting there. No doubt.
So, they were entertaining us, I think.
Very entertaining.
But nevertheless, they're talking about the fact that we are very fortunate to have this tradition and to have the apples that we need to make a really good, stable cider with great depth and great character and great astringency. And it has become clear to me in my time over here in America, whilst I've been travelling around, is that, you know, that is perhaps one of the biggest differences, that we're able to be pretty casual about we make it because actually the apples make it for us.
Right.
And I think some of the crafts cider makers over here are doing a much better job than we do back in the UK. You know, your skills actually are having to be honed to a much finer level than ours are because you've not got the ingredient to play with. Now, what's exciting is, and the reason why I'm excited, because my passion is growing apples, is that we're really starting to see some people starting to want to grow bittersweet apples here in the US. And that's, in turn, is going to really change the types and the designs of ciders that you're getting over here. It's great fun. So I suppose the regional question you asked me was, how on earth did I end up being over here in the US? And I suppose I ought to answer that.
Well, only if you wish.
Only in a roundabout way. So
take your time.
So, my background is farming, particularly apple growing, and with that history of cider making and having knowledge of a cider company and commercially growing cider apples for big cider makers and for craft cider makers as well. And I was fortunate enough to be granted a thing called a Nuffield Farming Scholarship. It's quite an honour. There's only about 10 to 15 scholars a year from the UK, and there are others around the world as well, and there are about 60 per year that are granted. And it gives us 2 years of travelling around the world studying our own subject, and then we have to write a paper on it at the end of it.
It's called the
Nuffield Farming Scholarship.
Nuffield.
Okay. And it's to do with Lord Nuffield, and Lord Nuffield supported hospitals in a big way, but actually Lord Nuffield was very fortunate too. He was given the opportunity to travel, and he had a bicycle repair shop, and he travelled.
A bicycle repair shop?
Yeah, well, he wasn't a lord back then. So
Can I ask you to spell Nuffield?
Nuffield is Nuffield.
Okay.
Nuffield.
Okay.
And he travelled to America to see what Henry Ford was doing with the car factories over here. Spent a bit of time over here, was so passionate and so excited about that. He went back home, grabbed a mate of his, and these are in the days when it was 6 weeks to get from one place to the other. You know, this was across the water. Grabbed a friend of his, came straight back again. They spent a bit more time, and then they went back and they invented the Morris Motor Company, Morris Cars.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
He married, never had any children, never had any brothers or sisters, left a great fortune and left it all to nursing, and also left it to a number of trusts, one of which was the Farming Trust, and it encouraged young people to go overseas to study their subject and come back and share that knowledge. And I was fortunate enough to receive one of those. I've just finished that. And so I've been all around the world looking at cider apple production, particularly a little bit about cider making, but more about the apple production. And so that's what afforded me a little bit of a chance to look around America. I'm back. I can't seem to stay away because although we in the UK and a little bit more in France maybe are perceived to be the experts in growing it because we have a long history of it, the passion and the diversity is happening right here in the US. So because I'm passionate about my industry, I want to be where it's happening, and it's happening here.
And when you say the diversity, I mean, people in the US kind of see that we are a little linear in our style of apples, which are primarily eating apples and not the bittersweet. So can you talk a little bit about the diversity that
we have? Yes. So,
or that you're seeing here right now, or that you're seeing that it's a viable new marketplace in that way for the bittersweet?
Yes, I do, because I think that the US styles of cider are always going to be completely different to those of anywhere else. And I'm not coming over and saying UK cider should take like US cider. That's not what it's about.
Sure.
But an awful lot of the ciders here in the US are based on dessert apple varieties.
Right.
that limits the sort of flavors that we can get from our ciders. There are really only two flavors that can come out of those dessert apples, however you grow them, and that is sweetness and acidity. And it's very hard to create what we have in our bittersweet apples, which is this great depth of tannin and astringency. It then limits, actually, the way you can ferment and make cider, because the joy of the bittersweets is they bring some antimicrobial activities. We allow them then to go through a second fermentation process called malolactic fermentation that brings a whole different set of flavors and depths and bits and pieces. If you do that with the dessert fruit, you lose the one flavor profile that you have left, which is acid, and you end up with a pretty insipid and uninteresting drink. What can you do with that? Okay, you can add hops to it or ginger or whatever, and you can funk it up somehow or other. And you've done a fabulous job of funking up cider. You know, you really have.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is the key thing that's growing in the UK are those artisan craft ciders, which are what we call full juice ciders, and are apple-based. Those are in growth. All the ones with other juices added or other styles are dying away. It's the true apple ciders that seem to be standing the test of time. So my advice to any cider maker here in the US is make a good quality apple cider. If it's good, it will stay. If it's poor, you'll lose sales and you'll fall away. Quality and drinkability. And I use the word quaffable a lot.
That's a good term.
If you can't quaff it, if you can't simply sink it, if you can only drink half a glass of it, you're not going to sell very much of it. This is a long, alcoholic, refreshing drink. And it should be easy to drink.
Right. I like that term, quaffable. Yeah, absolutely. Is there the option for U.S. cider makers to contact you, Neil, and get juice? Is that
It's a very good question. So what, besides my Nuffield's journey and my interest, what on earth am I doing here? Well, besides passion and just loving what you guys are doing and enjoying that, you know, I've got three boys to feed, you know, and educate. So you know, I've got to make a living as well.
So I'm
doing a number of things, and I'm really waiting to see what works out. And I really don't know. I just keep knowing if I hang around, sooner or later, somebody might, you know, cross my palm with something to be here. But there are several things I think that I can bring of benefit. One is, I think we could do with bringing a little bit of bittersweet juice across from the UK. We are producing 90% of the world's bittersweet is coming out of the UK. So quite frankly, you need a little bit of that right now. Even whilst you're growing bittersweet apples in the ground now, it's going to take a year or two before you've got enough to really start making some good cider. So maybe in the short term, we can get a bit of that liquid across. Just small percentages can really change the profiles of your cider and just diversify them. I'm not saying they have to do a lot of it, but it would just, it would give you another element of stability in your fermentation and taste profiles. So that's number one I can do. Now, whether that's in a concentrate form, and remember, concentrate is simply the removal of water and then you rehydrate it back up again. So I don't want anybody to get really concerned or frightened about, oh my goodness, how can you do that? You know, it's a very natural process, quite frankly, and it is simply the removal of water and you multiply it back up again. So it's a very stable way of moving it around and it's a very stable way of stopping it. Let's just remember that the whole idea of cider originally was done as a means of preserving a fruit for further use. So that's what it was all about. And so anyway, we have learned new skills, whatever, to preserve something, you know, let's embrace that. That can't be wrong. So anyway, concentrate we can get across the water. Straight juice we can get across the water. We obviously need to ferment it first to make it stable. I can't send something across that's, unless it comes across frozen, but I'm not a great believer in freezing juice. So we can do that.
Can you hear the passion in this man's voice? There was just so much info in this chat. So make sure to go to ciderchat.com, episode 19, Neil McDonald, Orchard Park Farm, UK, to find all that he's talking about here and also to get links to the different programs that he's talking on. Now for a word from our sponsor.
Cider Chat is brought to you by Cider Cellars Imports, celebrating British craft ciders.
Thank you very much, Linda. I am getting so thirsty here. So let's get back to this chat, because there's a lot more from Neil, including that job offer as an intern at Orchard Park Farm.
When you take out the water, are you taking out the water down to that ice cider level?
The ice cider is a slightly, compared to concentrate, it's a slightly different way of doing it. Now, I'm not an expert in ice cider, but I've tried some amazing ice cider since I've been over here.
Yeah.
And the first thing I did was went home to my team and said, we're going to make ice cider. And they all turned around and said, you're nuts, Neil. We'll never sell it over here in the UK. And we haven't got a clue how to do it. So go back and find out. So I'm coming back to find out. But and also I love the idea that you have the sort of climate where you can sit a big IBC of cider outside the back door. It naturally freezes because it's that cold outside. The sun comes up a little bit, the next day it thaws out, and you just take off the difference. That sounds really great to me. We don't have that kind of climate quite where we in Somerset to do that, but anyway, that's another matter.
So we
can bring the juice across. We can fully ferment some full bittersweets and send over a fermented product. That's and then an alcoholic product that's coming across the water. Slightly more complicated, but we can do.
Perfect.
So that's one thing we do. The other thing I really want to do is come and help people grow bittersweets. It's my passion. It's my love. We're involved with growing somewhere around 1,000 acres of bittersweet production in the UK. I'm doing some high density, although I don't think that's necessarily the way forward for cider growers here in the US. We're obviously into mechanical harvesting, so I've got some knowledge of the sort of equipment, how that works. I've got some knowledge of how to run a cidery, having built one up now that's doing somewhere around 3 to 4 million litres of cider each year. So we've got some experience. I just want to stop a few people falling into the potholes that I have in my career, and if I can help people do that in some way, that would give me a big kick.
That's a great offering.
And I'm also looking for apprentices. So at the moment I have a young lady called Emily Johnson who's here from here in Oregon, and we're in Oregon now, Portland, here at the CiderCon. And she came across to me in September. She's spending a year with me downloading everything I can on her from the point of view of cider making, orcharding, introducing her to all the greats, including the three we've had on the stage here today, and spending time with all of those so that she can come back with some really good knowledge and share it here. I'm looking for the next apprentice that I'd like to start in September and obviously next year as well. And if I found two, that'd be great. But I just think if we can do some across the pond communications, we share both ways. There's an awful lot to be said.
Fantastic. Okay, so Ciderville, you hear that. Neil's looking for an apprentice. And what are some of the qualities of that?
That I'm looking for an apprentice?
Yeah, right.
Well, firstly, 25 or above in age is really, I'm afraid, a parameter. If they've got a slightly scientific background, that's good. I'm obviously looking for a grafter, somebody who's prepared to get out in the field. Emily spent a couple of weeks on a mechanical cider harvester, driving that and operating that. She's obviously out in the field pruning. She's in the cidery racking and actually pressing and grading apples and all those things. So it's a graft job. It's reasonably well paid. It'll be a salaried job with holiday and all the rest of it. And getting the visa across is quite a complication, I have to say. So I'm looking for somebody practical, slightly scientific. They'll also be responsible for running some of the orchard trials that are going on in the UK. I'm a great experimenter. I do believe every orchard is a permanent experiment. You never get it right. We've been doing it in the UK for years and years and years, and we still haven't got it right. So we are permanently trying with different varieties, different rootstocks, different soil types, different nutrient levels, different chemicals, different mechanical harvesting, different mechanical pruning, summer shaping, winter, all sorts of stuff going on.
Are these trees standard size trees?
So I've got everything from high density, of which I tend to do the hand picking, and that's more a dessert fruit I'm using for my acid, because actually my problem is I'm short of acid fruit, whereas you've got too much. So I grow a little bit of the dessert fruit for acid that goes back into my... But I'm growing it for cider, so I don't really care what the colour or shape of my fruit is, okay? I just care about healthy trees with a good yield. So I'm doing a little bit of that on high density. I'm doing the majority in what we call our bush orchards in the UK, and I've got a lot of old traditional standard orchards that we're managing and maintaining and enjoying those. But the old standard orchards are absolutely wonderful from the point of view of wildlife and biodiversity and heritage. They're absolutely superb, but I'm afraid economically they're really falling by the wayside. Yeah. The majority of our cider is coming from bush trees. You need to remember the UK...
Let's define bush tree.
Okay, so a bush tree, we're trying to grow them in hedgerows, so we're on a freestanding rootstock. So from our point of view, that's something like a 111 or 106 or even an M25. Mm-hmm. We're doing some trials with A2, B118 and P18s as well. So all the bigger stuff. Anything smaller than a 111 or 106 will not withstand the mechanical processes that we put our trees through. So all the M9s, all the Genevas, they're not strong enough to do this.
Ooh, doggy Ciderville. Do you know what he is saying when he's saying 111 or 106 or M25 or Geneva? He's talking about rootstock. We talked about this in previous episodes where when you graft the tree, what you actually put the cider tree that you want on, like that core rootstock that comes out of the ground, and then they graft different shoots from that. So some obviously are going to be stronger than others in terms of mechanical harvesting, which I guess kind of shakes up the tree a little bit differently. I've never seen mechanical harvesting, so I can't really say for sure. I hope that we'll be bringing Ciderville into that world. Hang in there, and also hang in for the end of this chat, because I will be putting Neil a little bit on the spot here and having him describe a bit more about that intern offering at Orchard Park Farm. Lot more to come, so stay tuned. Now let's get back to this chat.
So that freestanding tree, we'll support them for the first 4 years, with the 4 or 5 years with a single wire, then we'll take the wire out, they're left freestanding. We're going to grow these trees to about 18 foot high. So we think about the box system when we're growing fruit. I think that's similar the world over. So if we're 18 foot apart in the rows, we want our trees to grow 18 foot high, and we want them to join up like a big hedge. Mm-hmm. Don't want any gaps, any V's and bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. Why do I want my rows 18 foot wide? Because I want to use mechanical harvesting and mechanical pruning. And actually, if you narrow that row too much, then you limit the sort of equipment you can use to get up and down there. Mm-hmm. Spacings between the trees within the rows varies depending on the rootstock, the consistency of the soil. If I've got a really rich, strong soil, I might have those at 7 or 8 foot apart, and I might have them on an M25 rootstock. If I've got I might have them on a 106 or a 111 rootstock. If I've got really weak soil, some of our Somerset soils are pretty heavy, fairly slow growing, then I'll put M25s and I'll close them down to even 5 foot apart. So I am sort of doing high density,
yes, you are,
freestanding,
yeah,
okay, but I'm growing a much bigger product. The key thing to this is my cost of establishment is considerably less than that, possibly half that of a high density one. And I reckon those trees are going to produce for me for 40 years. I think a high density, you're lucky if you do 15 to 20. Mm-hmm. Your trellising probably won't even stand up beyond 15.
Wow.
So it's a much longer, slower process. And we can still reach some pretty incredible yields on that, depending on where we are and what the soil types are.
Wow. I mean, you have this great wealth of information. I think folks listening to this chat can really say, dang, Neil, you got it going. And you're really moving that kind of economic scale and taking that approach. Because in order to succeed in cider making, you have to come in as a business.
We are commodity producers.
Right,
we
right,
absolutely right. are. And that is really important to me. And the other astounding thing that I think a lot of growers in here are really surprised by is I'm looking to put in 100 acres per man. So that's one man, one tractor, one sprayer, one harvester, one mechanical pruner per 100 acres. Per 100 acres. That's a unit. 40 hectares, 100 acres. That's
wow.
a unit.
Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So we are extensive commodity producers. Yeah, we need the quality.
Yeah.
But most importantly, we really do have to produce the volumes. There are two things when we're growing fruit that matter more than anything else. One is the price we get for it, and the second is the yield. Now, in order to get the price we want for it, we've got to be producing what our consumer wants. If our consumer is the cider maker, we have to be very clear about what that apple does for them. Is it the amount of juice it produces, i.e. varieties that are higher juice yielding than others? Mm-hmm. Is it the acid level? Is it the sugar level? Or usually in our case, is it the tannin level? So actually, I could be producing a lower yield of fruit, but a higher yield of tannin, and that might be worth the same amount of money. We really have to really work out what is our consumer truly is buying. Mm-hmm. It's not just apples. It is what creates the drink that they're trying to make. Mm-hmm. And we have a number of people we produce for in the UK who really do start to value things very differently. They pay us different rates for different types of apples, different tannin levels, different sugar levels. And they're starting to value that out. Those are the things that the cider maker is making money from, and therefore those are the things that he's going to pay the grower. And we do need to move a little bit further. So there's a whole structure here in the US that's missing. The whole mechanical harvesting, which means processing it ideally within 24 hours of harvest. So who's going to process that? You know, we have to allow the fruit to fall on the floor because we do not want to have that fruit until it's fully ripe, the sugars are fully turned, and the starches are gone from it. And the sure way to do that is to wait for it to fall. The concept that it falls on the orchard floor actually encourages the natural yeast that we want in that first ferment, and certainly the early fermentation comes from yeast from the orchards. Mm-hmm. The secondary tends to come from the fabrics of the buildings that it's coming from, rather than using cultured yeast. So actually a little bit of bruising to a small extent for a short period of time is a very good thing, and it helps accelerate that fermentation.
And that is unique for cider makers in the U.S. or orchardists, that they are pulling from the tree, which is very labor intensive and not necessarily waiting for the drops. Although, you know, typically the old style would be you pick up the apples on the ground, but there is a bit of not everybody's doing that. So I think
there's something that really does need clearing up here too, and it's quite a concern. There's two things in my mind that need clearing up. One was the one about concentrate. The second one was the one about, you call them drops or grounders or whatever you call them.
Yeah. Right, drops.
So let's be clear. I understand entirely that there's a lot of nervousness about drops, especially when it comes to what you call your sweet cider, what you just call our apple juice.
Right, and also there's the FDA and the kind of food quality and the government, so that's a big factor.
That's
that comes
a big factor,
play.
And I have to say, the way you make your apple juice is interesting to me and frightening, and you carry on, that's fine.
We're wearing our white suits.
Yeah, exactly.
Almost.
But the process of fermenting something changes the dynamics of this completely.
Yes.
You've only got to get 1% of alcohol by volume, and all those pathogens are completely gone, and you needn't worry. Mm-hmm. We're talking about taking a standard cider, naturally will go to 6 or 6.5% alcohol by volume. Mm-hmm. All these things are way behind us. It's done its own sterilization process. Now, I'm not saying you want to pick everything up from the orchard floor, from sheep muck to rats and mice or to whatever, slugs or whatever's
right,
in there. That's not ideal. It's not ideal.
No.
And I'm not saying you want to pick up apples that are completely rotten or turned to mush. Not what I'm saying. That's not what we do in the UK. Mm-hmm. Whatever the team might be perceiving to you down there.
Well, I have heard some stories.
You have heard some stories. And I'm sure you've heard the one about rats going in as well. And
being, I haven't.
Oh, well, I mean, well, if you think about the old cider houses that we were talking about, going back to the original part of our conversation, rats would have been all over the place. Those
Makes
sweet
sense.
Sugars, the apples and bits and pieces, that would run around. The vats would be open. Every now and again, a rat is going to fall into a vat. And you're not going to know it's there because it's going to drown and sink to the bottom until you empty the barrel and you'll find the skeletons.
Yeah.
Not an issue, because those yeasts will have eaten that rat. It's protein, meat is a high protein, and the yeast would have just gobbled that up, and the fermentation would have sterilized it, so no harm done. Indeed, many years ago, if you had a cider that was not starting to ferment for any reason, it was not uncommon to add a leg of mutton into a cider for a short period of time. The yeast would start feeding on the nutrient of the meat, get it going, and then you pull it out again, and then hopefully it's preserved enough you go and cook it and use it.
When they put the mutton in there, because Nat West at Reverend...
Oh, I heard.
Yes, right. I mean, he did a little bit different, I think, because he took like sausage and rubbed it on, you know. Would they just take like a fresh chunk
fresh,
of
fresh,
mutton and
fresh
just throw
mutton,
it right in there.
Yeah, they'd have tied it on the rope, dropped it in, mm-hmm. and they would have pulled it out and removed it. They wouldn't have left it there
left
to the end of the day.
Left it in there for too long. Yeah. So just a
But they were also there, doing things with treacles in order to change colour and get character. I mean, there is an element of we've forgotten more than we know.
Right.
And some of the old crafts have, you know, are slightly gone, and we've gone a bit stainless steel about it. But equally, too, I think we've also gone in another extreme where we've become more scientific about it. And what amazes me about the US market is it appears to me that most cider makers here in the US are either winemakers or brewers. And therefore, they've approached the art of cider making in two completely different ways. They come from a very clean, scientific, and are producing a very wine-like type cider. Like it or not, it's clean, it's fresh, it's well crafted. It's, you know, better crafted than many UK ciders. And if you had the right ingredients to start with, guys, you'd be making something fabulous.
Mm.
Or the brewers that have come in with their own, you know, hoppiness and the way they do it. Two very different ways to do it. And I also know, too, that in a lot of cases, the cideries just want the apple juice to turn up at the cidery door, and they want to do that bit of it. Now, that's just fine, but actually, there is a much closer interaction between the growing of the apples and the processing and the cider making, certainly for us traditionally.
Mm-hmm.
And I
yes.
think, and I think there is, to my mind, sometimes a little disconnect of the understanding of what juice is being brought forward for cider making, and there's a bit of confusion there as to what they're after.
This is great, and I think, you know, maybe we'll get some nibbles for you on the apprenticeship.
I hope so.
I hope so too, because that what an opportunity to do that. Geez, in another lifetime, I would have been like, "Whoa, you know, sign me up!"
Yeah.
And
you've got to spend a whole year in Somerset. You know, we are middle of nowhere, hick block.
Well, let's just talk about that, just for folks if they want to come to Somerset. What do you recommend to fly in and into?
Oh, Bristol's the place to fly into. Bristol. But you know, Heathrow, look, you've got to remember, we have a no concept of scale in the UK. Okay, so I took a flight from Grand Rapids to Detroit the other day that took an hour and something to do it, and I gathered I was sitting in the state of Michigan. If I did that same flight at home, I'd be out of northern Scotland and out of the country and across the water.
Right.
So, you know, I'm 2 hours south of London, you know, and I consider that to be a long way away.
Right,
you know,
right, so.
You guys would do it in a nanosecond. So I'm in Somerset, and you know, you can cross the border into Devon within half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
You can be in Cornwall within an hour and a half.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you can be in Bristol in an hour. So we're pretty localized. We're a pretty small team. And actually, do you know what? The whole UK cider making industry is a pretty neat bunch of guys.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a huge number of us, but the same as I found over here in the US, we all chat, we all talk, we're all good friends. We all share ideas, whether we're big commercial guys or little artisan makers.
Mm-hmm.
We're pretty free with our information.
Yes, I sense that, and a good sense of humor indeed.
So well, you've got to keep that if you want to stay in this game. That's for sure.
Now, if folks were to come out to Somerset and to visit Orchard Park, do you have a tasting room?
No, not at all. No, I'm not in that at all. So I am, for all intents and purposes, a commercial grower. And I commercially process some juice to go on to other little craft cider makers.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same way I'm saying your juice turns up at the cidery door, I process fruit for a number of little people, little guys. And we have a barrier in the UK of a duty level of 7,000, more or less 7,000 litres is a barrier. So there's a lot of people that make up to the 7,000, which means they don't have to pay duty on it. And these are hobbyists generally, and they don't generally have access to the apples that I might have or the processing equipment. So we process a lot for those sort of people. I also send a lot of fruit into the big manufacturers as well, Thatcher's and Magnus CNC and Sheppies and others.
Right.
And indeed, for our own Orchard Pig, we process and that all goes off for bottling.
Right.
So there's a number of things going on. So we're very commercial. We're not really a retail outlet there. However, my door is always open for anybody that is passionate and interested in cider making. I will gladly show them around what we're doing. I will gladly point in the direction of many others around me and introduce you to the wonderful family of cider makers.
Yay.
Yay.
Who
Chihuahua, no one, I mean no one, can ever say that cider folk are not passionate about what we do and what we love and love the apple, like this man, Neil McDonald, is. Now, I want to say put him on the spot. I mean, the guy was just so cool as a cucumber, and he's just brimming over with information. But I asked him to give us more detail about what would be involved with the internship and what you could expect if you do apply. Now remember, he actually said that there would be two possible openings. I'm not sure if they're filled yet, but this is something for you if this is where you're leaning towards. Man, oh, I would go on it in a New York minute, I guess. I mean, if I could, but I can't, so I won't. So I'm passing it to you and sharing it. And then afterwards, we're going to be hearing about an offering of a mobile juicer trailer that is for sale. So we'll get to that in a moment. Let's get back to Neil and talk about the internship at Orchard Park Farm in the UK.
It would be nice to have somebody in August, September time. So Emily leaves end of September, so it would be good to have a hand over there. Mm-hmm. And in time for harvest. We will help them get their visa across, which is $2,500 to get the visa for a 12-month. It's a real rigmarole. It takes about 3 months to organise that, so we need to be getting somebody lined up fairly soon. We will pay them a salary of £18,000 a year whilst they're with us. They will need to find their own accommodation and transport if they need us, but actually we found someone very close to the farm, so if they're a cyclist, they can, you know, 10-minute cycle, they're mm-hmm. into work every day, and from work we can transport them around, whatever it might be. It will include them doing every 2 weeks they go off for a day release with a college, Home Lacey College, to do the UK apprenticeship scheme. Mm-hmm. So they'll be meeting all the greats of cider making.
Wow.
They'll be spending time in the cidery, time pressing, time harvesting, time pruning, mm-hmm. planting, particularly running the trial work in the orchards and overseeing what Emily's doing mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. They'll be coming across to CiderCon with me annually so that we can start mm-hmm. to introduce them to the greats of the US.
Mm-hmm.
And the intention is that they would end up back here after 12 months trying to help promote ideas and from the cider.
And some of those apples.
And some of those apples.
More knowledge about it.
You know, quite where that leads from there, you know, is a very unknown. But all I do know is that they will come back with a very valuable resource that is heavily in demand right now. And where that's applied will become clear in the time that they're with us.
Fantastic.
Eek, is that like a deal or what? This really sounds so amazing to just go, and if you could do a sabbatical to work with this man, it would really be an opportunity, not to mention that you're in the UK. Imagine all the cider you would get to try. Woo. So this is what I'm going to do. I have the time that this starts in this chat and when it ends, and you could get that time if you go to ciderchat.com. There you'll see a nice photo of Neil. You'll get a little bit of a synopsis of the chat itself, some of the key things that I was pulling out, links to some of the things, including a link to contact Neil if you're interested in this work. So cool, cool stuff for us, Ciderville. And I'm just really thrilled to bring you this chat with Neil McDonald. All right. Ooh, I always have to like take a deep breath and exhale. There's so much going on here. Now, one of the big things that is going on that I want to share with you, if you've listened to the episode with Ryle Schallenberg from Montana, and let me see, what episode was that? I'll get it in a second as I'm chatting with you. Oh, here it is right here. That was Ryle, is episode 13, and he does mobile juicing, and that's where you bring a trailer, and you go to the orchard, and you could just load up the apples right there, process them. I mean, that is like create the pomace, put it in the press, and then create the juice, and you could also package it. It's an amazing little operation. There is a mobile juicer trailer available, and I have the info for that. I talked to the gentleman who is selling it. His name is Casey Oberg. He is based in Washington State. This is in the U.S., and I have his info here. So I'm going to essentially put this on the show notes too. He is a cider maker. He has a cidery. It's called Old Suede Cidery. And he creates cider of like blueberry and different styles. And he's been working really hard. I met him very briefly at CiderCon, and he told me that he wanted to move on this juicer. It is a brand new trailer. It's a little bit different than Ryle's. I think it doesn't have like a hard side. It flips up on the sides. Kind of imagine a trailer that you would pull snowmobiles in, and the sides kind of pull out and create an outer canopy. Instead of it being a hard shell, it's more of a soft shell there. It sounds like a nice little deal. You could talk to Casey directly about the details of this mobile juicing trailer if you think that this is viable for you. And really, they're the only two juicing trailers that I know of in the U.S. right now. And this market is going to increase, at least I believe. If I was, you know, in a different kind of lifetime right now than I am and not doing the podcast, I would definitely do this. I think it would be so much freaking fun going out to different orchards and helping out the local economy this way. Because when you think about the last year's harvest and how many apples were just being laid on the ground and just kind of being left there for the deer. I'm sure the deer had a lot of enjoyment out of it, and the bears, but you know, there could have been a lot of cider made there. So you'll be able to contact him. Again, you'll have to go to the show notes, or you could Google Ole Suede, and that is spelled O-L-E, and it's a separate word, S-W-E-D-E, Ole Suede. And again, it's in Washington. The guy's name is Casey Oberg. Really nice guy. Chat with him about that if you are so interested. So tons of stuff in this episode. We have Neil McDonald talking about everything that he's doing with Orchard and what he could offer to folks here in the U.S. Casey Oberg with the mobile juicing trailer. We have a new sponsor, or a founding sponsor, for Cider Chat. And we are going to be talking to some amazing people coming up. I just can't even begin. You know, we're going to have, next week, we're going to have Curtis Scherer from Millstone Cider. That's down in Maryland. And then the following week, it's going to be Bill Bradshaw. And I want to say, hey, Bill, thanks for joining the Facebook page at Cider Chat. You could join that too. There were some really cool people that just joined this past week. I want to give them a shout out because that's really, really nice to see that happening. Let's see, we have Charlotte. Well, Charlotte, I met you at CiderCon. You know, she works Far From the Tree Cidery. Also, Paul from Missouri, Meredith from Ferris State, Cindy from the great state of Utah, the land of the desert. Steve Watkins, it says that he's friends with Neil Worley. Oh my gosh, Worley Cider. Neil's going to be on an upcoming episode talking about keeving, which I so dig. And Neil, I don't want to challenge you too much, but you know, I'm going to start keeving when I get my juices fall. And watch out, buddy. I got all the fine tips now. Kitty. That's an incredible chat with him. And also Paul Russell, who I see works at Douglas Plumber Supplies in Taunton. And just thank you for joining that. And we're almost at 100 likes on the Facebook page. Now, that might not seem like a lot to you. To Cider Chat, we count every single like as just an amazing journey and hanging out with folks down on Orchard Lane. So who knows? You might be the 100th person if you go to Cider Chat at Facebook now and join in on some of this wild fun that we all have. Ooh, lots of great things. Now, this weekend, I'm going to be going up to my friend's house to talk about cheese pairings with cider. We're going to do a dry, a medium, and the sweet. So that should be really interesting. And also farm style. Okay, let me just admit to it. We're going to just be drinking a lot of cider and eating probably a lot of cheese. And I know that'll be beneficial for everyone because it's hard to know. You know, you get really focused on one kind of cider. And I'm going to try to get the range. So it doesn't really matter what cider you have. If you're in that kind of profile, hopefully Jim Wallace, who I'll be speaking with, will help us kind of sort that out. So if you're with your setting up a restaurant, or you have your tasting room at your cidery, this might be helpful. You know, I was sitting next to Neil McDonald during the cheese pairing at CiderCon, and he kept on saying, well, that's a train wreck. You could taste that, or this is like delicious. And I was thinking, oh my God, it all tastes good. So I have a lot to learn. I do not know everything. I mean, come on now. How boring would that be to hang out with somebody who knows everything? Ooh. Not me. Don't sign me up for that. Oh, all right. Well, I'm going to roll out of here. I just had so much fun this week with you hanging out in Ciderville. And, you know, give me a shout out on Twitter. Ask for the media kit if you are interested to sponsor. Like us on Facebook page. And certainly go to the show notes and get some of the info on everything that we were talking about on this chat. I want to thank our sponsor at CiderCellars.com for helping us with this episode of Cider Chat. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. I look forward to seeing you soon in Ciderville.